Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 7 days a week. I'm Dr. Kate Devlin. Psychedelics, the term coming from the Greek and translating as soul manifesting, or alternatively, mind manifesting, are types of drugs that have a history going back thousands of years for both spiritual and recreational use. Following a period of medical research from the 1950s to the early 1970s, most of these substances were classified as drugs of abuse with no recognised medical value. But in what's been described by experts as the biggest breakthrough in the treatment of mental health for 50 years, psychedelics are back, baby. We're joined today by Dr. Matt Wall, a cognitive neuroscientist at the medical imaging company Invicro and Imperial College London, which is home to the first formal academic centre for psychedelic research in the world. Matt specialises in fMRI, that's functional magnetic resonance imaging, and in psychopharmacology. Hello, Matt, and welcome to The Bunker.
Hi, Kate. Thanks. Great to be here.
Matt, let's start with a quick explanation of psychedelics. When you talk about the use of psychedelic drugs in psychiatry, what are these drugs that you're referring to?
So there's quite a few going on at the moment. So we often talk about what people call the classic psychedelics. So these would be LSD, psilocybin, which comes from magic mushrooms, and another one called DMT. Plus a couple of others that are less used, like mescaline, which comes from cactuses in North America. So they all have a particular action at a particular receptor in the brain called the serotonin 2A receptor or the 5-HT2A receptor. And that's what defines them as classic psychedelics. But then there are a number of other kind of non-classic or psychedelic-like compounds that are being really actively investigated in the same way or a similar way. Things like MDMA, ecstasy and ketamine and some more exotic things like ibogaine, which comes from a tree bark in West Africa.
So who benefits from the use of these? What kind of conditions can drugs like this address?
So most of the work that's been done so far has been in depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. So with depression, people have tended to use the classic psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin. And with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, they've tended to focus on the use of MDMA. But really, the interesting thing about these compounds is that they're what we call transdiagnostic. So they're not tied to any particular disorder. Unlike normal kind of psychiatric medicines, it's a really different paradigm. So With, for instance, say, anti-schizophrenic drugs, the theory is that you have an excess of a particular chemical called dopamine in schizophrenia. So we're going to give you some drugs which will reduce your level of dopamine, and that will hopefully help treat the condition. With psychedelics, it's a different way of thinking about it. The pharmacology of it is not tied to any particular disorder. And in fact, we think that probably they're going to be useful for a range of disorders, what people often call internalizing disorders. So disorders which are characterized by some kind of depression or anxiety or kind of bodily symptoms, somatic symptoms, as distinct from disorders like psychosis and things like that, which are often called externalizing disorders, where there's kind of disruption to behavior and things like that. We've got some data that they're useful in addiction, alcohol addiction, smoking addiction, and people are testing them for obsessive compulsive disorder. We're running a trial at the moment for eating disorders, various kinds of chronic pain problems. So it's a whole range of possible applications.
Well, this is incredible, just the sheer scope of this. And I'm very curious about your work and how you determine what these drugs do and the effects they have. Can you give us a quick overview of the way that fMRI plays a role in this?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, they have a lot of different effects. So they have really three classes of effects, I would say. So the first is the kind of obvious one that people use them for recreationally. So when you take these drugs, you have this very intense acute experience where you hallucinate and you have a trip, right? So that's the first class of effect. The second class really is that people have found that they have this quite rapid and intense antidepressant effect in the depression trials. So particularly psilocybin and other drugs like ketamine, it will lift people out of their depression very rapidly. And that effect also seems to persist somewhat over time. So even after the acute effects wear off, the trip, you get these antidepressant effects, which last for days, weeks, months, maybe even longer. And the third class of effect, which is maybe related to the second one, the more clinical effects, is effects on neuroplasticity, which is direct effects on the brain, effects on synapses and neurons in the brain, and really changing the way that the brain operates, changing maybe the number of synapses on particular neurons, and maybe helping to grow new synapses or new neurons. And this is one of the things that people are really interested in.
So these are things that you can look at through medical imaging that you can see in scans of people's brains?
Yes. So with the clinical trials that we've done with my colleagues at Imperial, we've always used fMRI scans as a key part of the clinical trial because we're interested in the clinical effects. We're interested in actually helping people get better with these things. But we're also really, you know, we're scientists, we're interested in how they actually work and what we can see them doing in the brain. And so we've been able to image people in various ways, sometimes looking at the really acute effects with the trip itself, and sometimes with patients looking at their brains before and after they do the therapy in order to try and figure out what's changed.
And can you talk us through some of your recent findings? What kind of things are you seeing?
So the theory about how these things work at a kind of at a brain level is something that's been developed as a result of these fMRI studies. So what we do is we use a technique called resting state fMRI, which is you have people lying in a scanner. Sometimes when you're doing fMRI, you have people doing little games or looking at pictures or movies or something. But resting state fMRI is different. You have people lying in the scanner doing nothing, and you just scan their brain. And it turns out this is quite a powerful technique for looking at not really brain activation, but the connections between different regions of the brain. In your normal waking state of consciousness, you have quite a well-defined pattern of connectivity in the brain. Lots of areas of the brain are all talking to each other. And that's quite a consistent pattern that we see across different people and across different species. What happens when you take a psychedelic is that pattern gets extremely disrupted, and you have areas of the brain that normally are talking to each other will not talk to each other quite so much, and areas of the brain that don't normally talk to each other will start talking to each other more. So it really kind of flattens the hierarchy of brain connectivity that we see and produces this much more random effect on the brain. And we can even see the kind of the remains of that effect or effects like that a couple of days after when we do these follow-up scans on patients. And we think that this disruption of the brain's network is probably a really key feature that's helping to drive these clinical effects. We think that's probably related to how much better people are feeling after they have this therapy.
Given that there is such a profound effect happening there and it seems really significant, these are clearly quite powerful drugs. Is it tricky for you as researchers to get clearance to work with these drugs? I mean, how much more difficult is it compared to, say, getting ethics clearance for medical studies in general?
It's insanely difficult. It's horribly, horribly difficult. So these drugs at the moment, they're what's called Schedule 1 in the UK, which is a way of classifying drugs, which means that they have no medical purpose at all. So there are other illegal drugs, like, for instance, opiate drugs like morphine, which is more or less the same as heroin, which are Schedule 2 because they clearly have a very clear use in medicine for pain relief and so on. So there's no particular reason why these drugs need to be Schedule 1. And what being Schedule 1 means is that you have to have a special license from the Home Office to work with these drugs and store them and buy them and so on. It makes them incredibly expensive to buy because there's only a few labs in the world that are able to produce them. You have to have lots of facilities, like you have to have a special locked safe that's bolted to the floor in a locked room and so on to store these drugs. It just makes the whole research process incredibly more difficult and time consuming and expensive.
So is the UK behind on this? Because we see reports from other countries where they're doing this research. So how different is the UK's approach?
I mean, the UK's drug policy is really quite far behind in all kinds of ways, not just with these drugs. You know, if you look at the US and Canada, they are way ahead on things like medical cannabis. And some US states are starting to talk about reclassifying or decriminalizing psychedelics now. In Canada, in some provinces, they've just legalized recreational cannabis, basically. And Canada's also talking about legalizing psychedelics. Australia is really leading the way, and they've just licensed psilocybin and MDMA for use as proper medicines. You can get MDMA and psilocybin prescribed in Australia now, in theory, although I think there's still only a few doctors using it because it's only been a couple of months. So, the UK is way behind. And, we don't really have much of a conversation about drug policy in the UK at the moment. I think it's not really on the political agenda for any of the main parties, unfortunately, which is a real shame.
Why do you think this interest in psychedelics is happening now? Do you think there's something at this time that makes us, as a society, more receptive to the idea of psychedelics? Is there a trend for it?
I mean, there's certainly a kind of groundswell of enthusiasm about it. A lot of it's been kicked off by stuff in the popular media and the popular press. There was a really popular book by a journalist called Michael Pollan, who then went on to do a Netflix series about this. And I think that's started a lot of the current trend. And we're seeing, interestingly, I don't know if you could say this is a good thing or not, but we're seeing psychedelics making a bit of a comeback in the recreational usage kind of black market as well. Whereas, previously it had been other things, more stimulant or MDMA maybe. Now we see LSD and psilocybin coming back in that space as well.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that because the findings that you're talking about all refer to the medicinal use of psychedelic drugs that are administered in measured doses under the supervision of licensed medical professionals. But as you say, we're also seeing a lot of discussion around these drugs being used outside of those clinical settings. And people are reporting benefits, but it's a really tricky area because, as you say, drug policy in the UK certainly doesn't support that. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there are now psychedelic retreats that you can go to in places where they're legal or kind of semi-legal. So there are retreats in the Netherlands where you can go. There are retreats in Jamaica. And these, I mean, I don't know much about them. I don't think they tend to have licensed medical professionals working there. I think it's a difficult area because you don't really know what you're walking into with these things. Then you have people doing what they call microdosing with these substances as well. So that's taking a very tiny dose, usually of LSD or psilocybin. Some people use MDMA. Some people do combinations of things. And the people that are into that, they claim some benefits from doing that. So they take the dose that you don't really feel, you don't get any hallucinations, you don't get a trip, but they claim that it makes them more alert or happier or have less anxiety or more creative. I think the jury's still out on that one as well. There's not a lot of evidence that it actually can work.
So as someone who lives with a chronic mental health condition, I'm really wary of taking any substances that might alter my conscious state. And I've been through a period of psychosis when I was in my 20s. And so I'm really nervous at the thought of taking anything that might remind me of that. But I hear these positive stories of other people's experiences of things like microdosing. But are there people for whom this kind of treatment just wouldn't be suitable?
I think there probably are, yes. So that's a really good point that you've raised there. So most of the, pretty much all of the clinical trials that have been done with psychedelics up to this point, they've generally been really careful to exclude people with any kind of psychotic disorder. Sometimes they even exclude people who have a first degree relative that's had any kind of psychotic disorder or other things like bipolar disorder. Because of this fear that it may exacerbate those problems for some people. But I mean, the idea with these treatments is that they will at some point become more widely available. And at that point, I think we're going to have to grapple with this problem of which people are they really suitable for and which people really shouldn't be taking them. And same issue recreationally as well. I think there are some people who get on fine with these drugs and there are others who have problems with them.
And when you mentioned there about, you know, if they do become more widespread, they may, you know, this, if they prove successful, they might end up being regulated and licensed for prescription within the UK. Is that a very long, drawn-out process?
Well, I think so. In the UK, because of the legal situation at the moment. I mean, like I said, in Australia, that's already happened. In the US, it's likely that there's an organisation called the MAPS organisation, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Science, and they've invested a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money into getting MDMA trials done, and with the aim of getting MDMA licensed as a therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder with the American Food and Drug Administration. And that's an incredibly difficult and long drawn out process, but they are nearly there. And the expectation is that that will happen sometime next year. There's another company called Compass, which is trying to do the same thing for psilocybin for depression. So again, you know, the US is leading the way. US and Australia are leading the way. We're lagging behind a bit in the UK. The hope, I guess, is that if these things get through the FDA, maybe these companies then turn their attention to the EMA, the European Medicines Association, try to make some progress there. If there's enough of a positive result there and there's enough of a kind of groundswell of public demand for these things, then maybe it will start to move things in the right direction in this country as well.
You mentioned MDMA there, and I was recently having a conversation with someone about how animals respond to recreational drugs. And they were telling me about a study that showed that octopuses on MDMA show much greater sociality and they get very touchy-feely with each other. And I wanted to know if they were waving their arms in the air and going, whoop, whoop. And I just think this is fascinating, but octopus brains are so very different from human brains. So in this case, we're not just seeing drugs here as a form of therapeutic treatment, but this is about the discovery of brain chemistry differences and about how brains work. And you mentioned that earlier about other species. So that must be a fascinating new insight.
Yeah, that sounds like a brilliant study. There's some old stuff where they gave spiders a load of different psychedelics as well, and then looked at the kind of webs they produced. And they ended up with these really weird chaotic patterns in the webs rather than the normal regular web patterns.
Oh,
but
wow.
Yeah, I mean, so the molecule that psychedelics mimic in the brain, serotonin, is very evolutionarily conserved. So yeah, I think serotonin is definitely in octopuses and lizards and fish and what have you. And yeah, maybe it will have some kind of similar effect there. But your point about using them to investigate the mind and the brain is a really good one as well. And I think we're some way off from that. So we're very focused on these kind of clinical uses. But for me, as a kind of psychologist and scientist, I would love to use these things in a more kind of basic science way, just to look at how the brain works and how the mind works. These are the most powerful consciousness altering things that we know of. You know, with psychedelics like DMT, you can literally zap people away from this reality entirely into another dimension of alien beings and craziness. So I would love to be able to use these compounds as kind of probes of consciousness and probes of the mind and the brain to try and figure out how these things are working. I think we're still some way off from that, and the legal situation is a problem there again as well.
Oh, when we say these things are mind expanding, we really do mean it.
They really can be, yeah.
Matt, thank you very much for joining me on The Bunker.
Thank you. It was great.
I'd like to remind listeners in the UK that for anyone seeking crisis support, the Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123, or you can email joe@samaritans.org. Listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please support The Bunker on Patreon. For as little as £3 a month, you can get perks like ad-free episodes. I'm Dr. Kate Devlin, and thank you for listening.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election, and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Dr. Kate Devlin. The producer was Liam Tate, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.